session number 22170, reel 1.
Mr. Nick Berryman, reel 1.
Okay, my name is Nick Berryman. Actually, my name isn't Nick Berryman, my name is Neville Henry Berryman. And I was born on the 1st of September 1922. I was born in Fulham in London. And my father at the time had served in World War I in the Honourable Artillery Company. After father came out of the war in 1918, he was pretty sick of war and he had one ambition, and that was to get into banking well and truly and get married and have children. He was very fortunate because he met my mother, and she was a very loving and a very beautiful woman. And she came from Fulham as well. And my father at the time was a clerk with the London and South Western Bank, which later became Barclays Bank. He was a very good-looking man, and I feel quite sure that he set the hearts of many ladies in South West London aflutter. But my mother obviously had eyes on him and captured him. And in 1922, I was born, and my father had come from Wales, and he particularly enjoyed all the sports and all the privilege of the London theatres and operas and tennis and that sort of thing that was, in his view, of his suitable for his standing. I was, as I say, born 1st September 1922, and I was followed by a brother on the 2nd of November 1922, 4 years later, 1926. My brother Alan William Berryman. By the time we'd gone through all our nonsense periods, and father had decided that I should be properly educated, I was dispatched from a private school in Acton, where father was by that time a bank manager at 220 Horn Lane, Acton, right opposite the Great Western Railway Station. And I was dispatched very soon after he left there to go to Millbank first, and then on to Chelsea when he was a manager at King's Road, Chelsea. On the corner of Markham Square, that is where Barclays Bank was at the time, and certainly we boys were very privileged because we were introduced to a lot of well-known artists and a lot of well-known authors. And it wasn't long before I was sent off to Mercer's School in Holborn. Mercer's School was one of the guild schools. You had mercers, merchant tailors, haberdashers, and I was very privileged, and I know these days that I was exceedingly lucky to be sent to such a school because it gave me confidence and it gave me standards to work to and taught me, I suppose, which hand to hold my knife and how to handle my fork and how to be respectful to people. And all that, as far as I was concerned, living and growing up in the age of 1930, 33, 40 and into the war years must have helped me in whatever career I had chosen. I wasn't an academic boy at school. And I think really both my parents and my headmaster really despaired of me. However, I think what they did see in my personality was a little bit of outgoing and a little entrepreneurial. I was good on the stage, I was good with amateur dramatics and sports, So I was an outgoing child.
What sort of sports?
Oh, I was very athletic. I boxed a lot, and I ran mostly. Well, I had to adjust my running because by nature I was a sprinter. But I wasn't a big boy. I was only 5'8½. In those days, probably 5'7". But I wasn't winning, after a little while, the races that I used to win, which was the 100 yards, 220 yards. But bigger boys, one of which I'm meeting in a fortnight's time still, one of the survivors, used to beat me at those sort of distances. They would run, even in those days, 100 yards in sort of 10.7, and that they were, in many cases, London Public School champions. So I had to change horses, and I learned to make my mark by running the quarter mile, half mile, and the mile. And I certainly did make my mark. I can't say that I was the best in the school, but I could always hold my own, and I was quite a useful leader for the house, which was, we had four houses in the school. It was a London-based school, as I had said, and the houses were named after well-known people. Acon, Sir Thomas of Acon, who was, of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Collett, Dean Collett, and the Gresham, the Exchange, Gresham, and Whittington, of course, the Lord Mayor of London. And I was Acon House, and I was very pleased and proud to lead my brother 4 years later into all the wicked ways and wiles of how to make our mark for the house in relation to the school. By the time I was not academic, as I said, and by the time I became 17, or just coming up to 17, the war, World War II, was about to burst into life. A lot of the boys in the school, by this time they were in fifth and sixth form, had already made their mind up that they were going to do their best for the British nation in either the army, the navy, or the air force. As I've said, we were taught discipline, and we knew we had a duty to perform without any doubt, and I'm absolutely certain that is why when you go to the big public schools, of any public school, go to Mercer's Company in London today, and you will see the number of boys that of my time that died in World War I and World War II. And I look at that board with pride, because they were the guys that I served with and I laughed with and I was competing against. And I'm sorry they didn't survive, and I'm very lucky that I did. But at age 17, or closing up 17, my headmaster decided I'd got to take my matriculation exam. And in order to pass a matriculation exam, I'm pretty certain in remembering that we had to have six passes, one of which had to have a credit. And I wasn't of that caliber, and believe you me, I didn't get my matriculation. However, I did get my general school certificate, which was the next best thing. My brother, meanwhile, was very academic, very clever, and my father was delighted when he won a half-fee scholarship, first of all, and then won a full scholarship to Mercer School. So while I was costing him 8 guineas a term, my brother was costing him nothing. At the age of 17, my headmaster wrote a report to say that I should go out into industry, and I would be very suitable to do one of two things. He thought that I would make a very good solicitor's clerk. In retrospect, I think probably I would, but it didn't turn out that way. and or I could choose to go into the forces. He thought I would be quite good at either. So at the age of 17, I go out into the world, and it wasn't quite time for a boy of 17 to join World War II as such. I played about with an idea of getting a job with the Daily Mail, and I wrote them an essay on the future of British merchant shipping. Well, the essay wasn't very good, and neither was the estimation of the British merchant shipping future. I didn't think there was a great deal of future for that, and I think they must have seen through the humour and they decided I was not going to make a good junior reporter. So I didn't get that job. I then went to Unilever's, the soap people, at Blackfriars in London, and they didn't need me either. And in desperation, I said to my father, I think I'd better pay my mother some money for my keep. I'm now 17 years of age, which I was on September the 1st, 1939. And my father agreed, because being a banker, he could always see the value of money. And he decided that, yes, 15 shillings a week would be a very good amount of money to pay my mother for my keep. And I said to him, well, you'd better get me a job with Barclays Bank. Well, I think he must have pulled a few strings, because I wasn't going to say it, but he was a Freemason, and they were the days when Freemasonry counted a little bit. Number one, he was a bank manager. Number two, he was a very good and a very proud Freemason, in the days when Freemasonry was rather more respected than it is today. And whereas I'm very happy with my pursuits, like being with the museum, his pursuits were being a bank manager and being a very good Freemason. So it wasn't long before I was called for an interview, and I must have passed muster, because I was sent within a week of the interview to Barclays Bank, Melbury Court, Kensington, which was at the lower end of Kensington High Street. This was a very privileged branch to be sent to, because without any doubt, Kensington, as it is today, is still Kensington. And just as my father had a very good branch at Chelsea in King's Road, although I was a junior clerk and he was a manager, we moved in the same circle, shall we say. And I think I benefited by being at such a branch. I don't know that I would have done very well in Stepney or somewhere like that, but certainly I was considered past muster again at Melbury Court, Kensington. And I wasn't long, of course, before World War I really started, in as much as that...
Sorry, World War II,
I beg your pardon, and World War II started, in as much as that, whereas we used to work certainly 5 full days a week and a Saturday morning right up until lunchtime, that was from literally 8:30 in the morning until lunch, which was about 1 o'clock on a Saturday. On a Saturday, we were privileged and allowed to wear a sports jacket and flannel trousers. Other times, we were obliged to wear a full suit. And I remember my father had my first suit tailored for me. I still remember the tailor's name. He was in the King's Road, Chelsea, and his name was Candler. And it cost me 5 guineas. But that was my first suit that I went to business in. Sometimes from Ealing, where I lived at the time, I lived at Queen Anne's Gardens, Ealing, London, W5. It was a very nice house, and it cost my father £1,000 in 1937. It was just very near the Gunnersbury Avenue, and I suppose that house today would be about 350,000, something like that.
Maybe more.
But anyway, from there, I used to either walk across Ealing Common and get a tube train to Hammersmith and walk up from Hammersmith to Kensington, or sometimes I would cycle. As the pennies got shorter and I had a girlfriend or two, I used to save the money to take my girlfriend to pictures or something like that, and I've no doubt cycled as much as I could. Meanwhile, my brother, with rolled umbrella and a bowler hat, would be going to Mercer's school, trying to ignore me because I had a muffler around my neck and shouting whoopee or something like that as I passed him. However, in 1940, in January, the first signs of the real war started. My father was very distressed that the war had started, and he joined quickly the LDV, the Local Defence Volunteers, which later became the Home Guard. And he was very pleased to be carrying his rifle around and doing his best to ward off any impending danger if necessary, whilst I kept cycling to work. And when the bombing started in, let's go through 1940 first. In 1940, of course, the British had started taking the war to the Germans. And the first raids on the Kiel Canal by the Wellington Mark I's were taking place. We had also the Fairy Battle, the Hurricane, and the Spitfire. The Fairy Battle was certainly taking an awful caning every time. It was a light bomber, and it took an awful caning every time it appeared over enemy territory. And whole squadrons were literally wiped out, whereas the Hurricanes and the Spitfires were much more able to hold their own. But until about March and April 1940, there was very little sign of German forces coming into England or over England. Certainly by May, June, when I was on my way to work, I would look up enviously at the skies to see our Spitfires and Hurricanes firing away and the contrails up at 20,000 feet. And I decided that certainly I was going to get mixed up with this as soon as I could. I could see it was going to be an exciting time, but my leanings were towards joining the Fleet Air Arm. God knows why I thought I'd join the Fleet Air Arm. I think it must have been something to do with the fact that it was a dark blue uniform and I probably liked the ideas from gold braid, despite the fact that I don't think at that time I was anywhere near commissionable. But anyway, the day came in 1940, I was putting out firebombs that were being dropped by the Germans over London. And they would often drop on the bank, and as a young man, aged 17 and a half, I was either putting out firebombs on top of the bank. I was sometimes down in the bowels of the earth guarding the boxes of silver and valuables of the people that lived in and around Kensington, and sometimes I was kissing the cleaner's daughter. But
how did it come about that you had those duties?
Well, there was nobody. I was a bank employee. And as a bank employee, I was expected to do exactly what I was asked to do. And when my manager said, somebody will have to guard these premises overnight, we couldn't expect the police or the army to do that. I knew where the safe was. I had the keys to the safe. And it was my duty. And I was 17 and three quarters. And I was a responsible boy. And and I would do my duty, and I would guard the strong boxes and do my best to see that Barclays Bank was well served, for which I got paid 25 shillings a week. And anyway, the time came when one night I stood outside my own house in Ealing, West London, and it must have been about the November, when I could have read a newspaper by the light of the fires in the City of London. So many of my school friends and people that I knew, of course, lived in and around the city, and sometimes I would be phoning them up to find that they were completely and utterly homeless. And I felt very sorry for that, and very often my father and mother would give some of my friends a bed for the night and see that they were safe. By 1941, in July, I had done about well over a year with Barclays Bank. In fact, it was in the May 1941 when I got on my bicycle with the permission of my manager, cycled to Hornley in Acton, where I was determined on that lunch hour to join the Fleet Air Arm. I went into the drill hall in Hornley in Acton, where the signing on should have taken place. But when I went down to the Navy office, it said closed for lunch. And I knew damn well that my manager was no way going to give me another half an hour off to go and join the Queen's Light Infantry. So the Air Force office said open for business, and I went in and I signed on the dotted line. As bidden, ear, ear and ear. And I found myself cycling back to work very proudly with a little badge in my lapel that said Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, which I still have. And another 2 months passed by, and I was bidden to attend a medical examination and an initial interview at Weston-super-Mare. So I boarded the train at Acton Town and made my way westward to Weston-super-Mare. It was the first time that I had really got mixed up with having to live completely and utterly on my own. Meanwhile, the carriages were completely and utterly blacked out, and the steam trains puffed their way valiantly through the night to get to Weston-super-Mare, sometimes being bombed on the way.
What was the reaction of your family when you left home?
My father was exceedingly proud that when I had signed on, that I had been offered the job of being either a pilot, an observer, as it was then, which was now navigator, or air gunner, wireless operator air gunner. And to be honest, there was little that any of us could have done about which trade we ended up in. I think a certain amount of luck, a certain amount of savoir-faire, a certain amount of in RAF language bull, probably helped. But anyway, to Weston-super-Mare I went. My mother was really quite sad, and she hadn't worked for many years, but by this time she was working for a friend of my father who was a London solicitor. And because everybody in those days was doing their bit. Father was exceedingly proud of the fact that I had joined up, but I suppose, like most parents, he was a bit devastated because I had seen the reaction when when the Prime Minister of the day, Chamberlain, announced that Britain was at war with Germany, I looked across to my father and the tears were running down his face, because he knew that just like he had suffered in the trenches, that it was more than likely that in some shape or form his eldest son would suffer too. However, off to Weston-super-Mare I go, and I obviously pleased the powers that be down there with the Royal Air Force, and the following day I was put back on the train again to say, well, you will hear further from us. I did hear from them. I heard from them approximately 3 weeks later. And in the July, I was quite happy to go to my Barclays Bank manager, Mr. Jarvis, and say, sir, I am leaving Barclays Bank to join the Royal Air Force. A lot of the chaps clapped me on the back, said, well done, I'm sure you'll do well. I remember the typist, Miss Gould, she cried and gave me a currant bun or something as a little thank you for being such a brave boy. Anyway, I parted with Barclays Bank and found myself reporting to St. John's Wood, Lord's Cricket Ground, on the 11th of July, 1941. It became apparent to me straight away that navigator or observer, as you wish to call it, and gunner were going to be out for me, and I had been chosen to be a pilot. In retrospect, again, I say this was because my school reports had gone with me, and the fact that I was quite happy standing on my head. I was a good athlete, I was a good gymnast, and I was exceedingly good with my boxing, and I think that must have helped them make a decision as to if they wanted somebody who would fight to the death, it would probably be me. I think that, you know, humble I might be, but I think I would have done. In fact, I know I would have done, because I rather fancy, I showed you the letter that I had in the museum, where I stated that I would die happily if I died for England. However, that's beside the point. At that time, I was an AC2 with very sore feet, because I was given at Lord's Cricket Ground a pair of boots that fitted me, but I'd never worn boots in my life, and it didn't take very long marching from a block of flats in St. John's Wood to where we were billeted and being bombed at night when we'd all have to go down into the shelters. And then we were given a uniform. The uniform didn't fit exactly, but somehow we made it fit and we became reasonably smart. And then were taught to march for the first time. That didn't take too long, because in order to get to eat, we had to march. And in order to march properly, you were put into line and you were shouted at until you did march properly. And my feet got more sore and more sore, so that I reported sick. A lot of the chaps, too, used to have inoculations. And I've seen many a brave fellow collapse, unconscious, fainting, because he'd seen the needle shoved into the bloke in front of him. Then from after, a lot of funny things happened there. I remember going down to Swiss Cottage